Young Lords Organization, SDS, and other radical and revolutionary organizations and members and leaders. And of course, legal aid did not countenance such representation out of their offices. So they basically gave an ultimatum and said, either you stop representing these folks or you're no longer working with us. So the lawyers took the initiative to go out on their own and to find an old sausage shop on the near west and north side of Chicago. And we made it into an office. And previous, as I said, we'd been representing various organizations, most prominently the Black Panther Party and its young, very charismatic leader, Chairman Fred Hampton. And so we moved into the office. The lawyers were Dennis Cunningham, Don Stang, Francis Skip Andrew, and Jeff Haas, and several of us law students as well. And we took the name People's Law Office. There's several explanations for why, but the one I like the best is that the Panthers, of course, had the People's Breakfast Program and the People's Medical Clinic, and we were their lawyers, and so we were the people's lawyers in the sense, so we were the People's Law Office, and so that's how we were named, and we take that name very seriously. And so within months of the founding of the People's Law Office in December 4th of 1969, Fred Hampton, the chairman that I mentioned of the Black Panther Party, who was perhaps the foremost upcoming Black Panther leader in the entire country at that point, and Mark Clark, a leader from Peoria, Illinois, who was visiting Chicago, were assassinated in the early morning hours by a group of 14 Chicago police officers who were formed their own little unit under the chief prosecutor of Cook County, Edward V. Hanrahan. And that raid left both Hampton and Clark dead, and five of the other young Panthers in the apartment wounded. They were all, the seven survivors were charged with attempted murder, certainly a frame job. And that led to this 13 years of litigation in the criminal courts and in the federal courts of Cook County, having to do with exposing the truth about the assassination of Fred Hampton.
So jumping ahead just a little bit, Edward Hanrahan, at least in the first part of the book, is something of an antagonist. He figures prominently in the conviction machine, and he seems to embody many of the political and social currents which the Black Panthers were sort of in conflict with or swimming against. Can you talk a little bit about who he was and, you know, I guess where he figured in the Chicago political machine?
I think to say that he was a bit of an antagonist is quite an understatement, particularly in the book. I focused on prosecutors. As you know, the title of the book is The Conviction Machine, which is kind of an extension of The Torture Machine, my first book. But The Conviction Machine is prosecutors, politicians, and police violence in Chicago. And so I looked at Hanrahan and all of the state's attorneys, the assistant prosecutors who worked for him during that era. And the era we're talking about is 1968 through 1972, specifically. Hanrahan was elected in 1968. He was part of the Democratic machine. He was perhaps, or was, the second most powerful politician in the city of Chicago. At that point, Richard J. Daley, the father of Richard M. Daley, who had been the mayor of the city of Chicago for over 15 years at that point. He was headed towards either retirement or passing the torch. And the person who was expected to have the torch passed to was none other than Edward V. Hanrahan. And Hanrahan was a person larger than life that was very much a advocate of quote, law and order, which was a thinly veiled attack here in that time on the Black community in general, on the youth in the Black community in particular, and even more particularly on what he called and what he unveiled along with the mayor, the war on gangs. And the war on gangs, again, was a euphemism for a war on Black organizations. There were many strong street organizations in the city of Chicago, as well as several revolutionary groups. And the most prominent of those Black groups, of course, was the Black Panthers. So that war on gangs was in reality a war not only on gangs in the city of Chicago, but particularly against the Black Panther Party. And so from there, Hanrahan, within a year of his election in late 1968, had taken the war on gangs all the way to 2337 West Monroe Street, which was the apartment that his little group of Chicago police officers that were assigned to him, 14 in number, attacked and raided and murdered the morning of December 4th.
Sort of a, maybe slightly off the topic, but I wonder at what point, in your opinion, the Black Panthers became to authorities such a threat.
Well, I think it started almost as soon as the Panthers were born in Oakland in 1966 with Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, because the Panthers had a 10-point program. And the 10-point program covered many what we call now socialist programs, the breakfast program, for example, the health program. It was serving the people. They had a newspaper, but they also were very much in opposition to the war in Vietnam that was happening at that time. Their program called for resisting going to fight. The program also called for the abolition of prisons, in essence, the release of political prisoners. And it also quite prominently called for self-defense. Self-defense against the rampant police brutality and police violence that we found in the various, particularly in the Black and poor communities across the country. And certainly Chicago was one of those communities. So local authorities, local police, very early on came in conflict with and focused it, the Black Panther Party, for attack, for ultimate neutralization and destruction. And of course, J. Edgar Hoover, who was the head of the FBI for decades at that point, he totally got involved in going after the Black Panther Party with his, among other things, his secret COINTELPRO or counterintelligence program. So that was at some point Hoover told Congress that the Panthers were the biggest threat to the internal security of the country. And so the focus shifted from the mid-60s, which was an attack on the Black liberation movement, Malcolm X, for example, Martin Luther King, Stokely Carmichael of the Students Nonviolence Coordinating Committee. And as the Panthers blossomed in the North, particularly starting in California and then moving east to New York and Chicago and all over the country, they became the focus of COINTELPRO and were targeted for neutralization. The term that was used was popular with the FBI, and ultimately for destruction or to attempt to destroy their leadership, who were marked as those whom I named, and also for, in their own words, the FBI's own words, to prevent the rise of a messiah who would unify and electrify the Black nationalist movement. So they were looking to not only neutralize the leadership from Dr. King all the way to Malcolm X and Fred Hampton, but they were very concerned with disrupting and preventing the unification and the coalitions between Black and Latin and radical white organizations in the late 60s.
Thank you very much for that. Moving a little bit into the process of constructing these narratives, both of your books have been placed into narrative form, in my understanding, based on your notes and your records. What are the challenges of piecing together a story in this way? And Can you talk a little bit about the process of writing these books?
Well, you know, for many years, as I mentioned earlier, I had been fortunate enough to be involved in significant, highly significant political cases that involved the police and prosecutors and politicians. And from time to time, people would say, hey, you ought to write a book about that. And so as I neared 50 years in my career back in the late teens, I said, well, maybe I will do that. And so I started to think about writing and actually did start to write. And what I was able to do, because I was in the unique position of having lived through and been one of the persons who fought against the powers that be in these cases, I not only had a memory of them, but I also had kept pretty religiously records. I mean, I had transcripts. I had transcripts from the infamous or famous Panther trials. I had transcripts from all of the torture cases. I had briefs and other things that we all had written from time to time. I had all sorts of articles that I had collected. So I was able to put together on paper a history that not only had in it the detailed factual data that I had collected, but because I had lived through it, it also, I had my perspective and my own understanding and memories. So that was how it came together. It was no easy feat to do it. The torture machine ended up being around 550 pages long, so I took 2 or 3 years to write that piece by piece, chapter by chapter, sometimes in the evenings because I was still an active lawyer at that time. But I was fortunate, and with regard to the torture machine and again with the conviction machine, to have a very, very skilled, sympathetic, and understanding editor at Haymarket, woman by the name of Carolyn Luft. And she took what was a lawyer writing and helped to make it more understandable.
Susan Dietrich Schneider, otherwise known as the Space Lady, and I'm here in Angeles National Forest with Jacob and Nick and Far Off Sounds, and I'm just pleased and honored to be here with you and with you all. Joel was a force of nature. That's the only way I can describe him. He was magnanimous, a big guy with a big heart and a huge intellect. He had tried to apply for a conscientious objector status during the Vietnam War in the draft, and he was denied. So he had, as he saw it, no alternative but to either go to Canada or just live really low-key underground, so to speak, in the U.S. He was very, very frightened. He couldn't countenance the idea of going to a small country on the other side of the earth and shoot people, peasants. He had nothing against, he had nothing but loved people. So we ended up living like refugees in our own country. The Space Lady evolved out after a long stint of hand-to-mouth subsistence living in Boston. I kept looking up at seagulls and seeing how effortlessly they flew. I realized I can't continue this way of life and be responsible for my daughter. And so the gears started turning and I started watching seagulls up in the sky. How do they do it? They just so effortlessly sustain their livelihood, their existence. And so they became kind of a focal point for me. And I just had the understanding that if you are in tune with nature, nature will take care of you. Mother Earth does care about us. And she cared about those seagulls. And I just had that as a constant image, like my totem was the seagull.
You guys are awesome. We're so excited. We're so excited that the space lady is here.
Yes.
But very briefly, we would like to bring up Eric Schneider,
the space manager. Here, say a word.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, having just recently completed her first world tour and embarking on her second world tour, starting here at Cine Family. Please welcome the extraordinary, unique Space Lady!
Of marriage to Joel and 20 years of street music, I decided it was time to move on. And I packed up the space lady and retired her. I left California and left Joel.
When we were first getting to know each other, she probably mentioned that she had been a street musician. I knew she could sing and she played a few instruments, flute, accordion. I'm not even sure I knew she played the keyboard, but I knew she played piano. So a couple of years into our marriage, I started noticing she keeps getting these emails from all over the world. Whatever happened to the space lady? Where can we hear you? Are you still playing? She told me a little bit about it, about her history on the street. And so she played, and my mouth dropped open, literally. I said, this is insane. That's amazing. You have to come out of retirement. And she said, I'm really afraid, really scared. I said, I got it. I'll be your manager. Oh, well, that's when I told her, sit down in front of your computer. How many fans you have in your Hotmail address book? She said, about 1,000. I said, good, send them all an email. The Space Lady is back.
I will be back.
Big round of applause. Thanks so much, everybody.
I hear your voice. I hear your voice.
just trying to show off her talent or show people how loud she is. Or she's really trying to communicate something. You can never say for sure what makes somebody successful, but I think those things are big deals for the audience, and they love her.
Als je Marinus van Lubbe zegt, zeg je 27 februari 1934. Ik vond het een initiatief voor... voor die steen voor meneer van Lubbe is dus genomen door een kunstenaarsduo Sluik-Kurkbezoek. En daar ben ik de eerste helft van.
Ah, oh, oké, okay. Daar is Sluik van.
Alright. Sluik en Kurkbezoek was een kunstenaarsduo in de 80 en 90 jaren actief in de Nederlanden. En wij, Marinus kwam op ons pad. Ik was eigenlijk al heel vroeg geïntrigeerd door dat hij ooit, niet die brand ook, maar dat hij dus eens een keer is gaan wandelen naar Peking.
Ja, dat wist ik.
En daar heeft hij, en daar heeft hij een dagboekje van bijgehouden.
Wow.
Dat begint ermee dat hij, de eerste zin in het boekje is, er was eens een Chinees en die zei, zonder de deur uit te gaan ken ik de wereld. En daar ben ik het helemaal mee eens, zei Marinus. En dan sla je de bladzijde om en zegt van, ik ben vandaag vertrokken uit Leiden richting Peking. Dus zonder mijn huis uit te gaan ken ik de wereld, daar ben ik het helemaal mee eens. En dan de volgende bladzijde,
hup, op reis.
Zo. Geweldig. Ja, toch? Marinus van Lubbe is nooit in Peking terechtgekomen. Hij is teruggestuurd bij de poort aan de Donau, bij de Roemeense grens.
Wow.
Daar is hij teruggestuurd omdat de Roemeense douane zei van, jij bent een landloper, je hebt geen geld en landlopers hebben wij in Roemenië niet nodig.
Hij ging terug.
En is gewoon weer teruggewandeld. De muur was gevallen begin jaren 90 in Duitsland. En in Leipzig speelde het verhaal dat er nieuwe namen voor verschillende plekken verzonnen moesten worden.
Oké.
In Leipzig was het gerechtshof waar vanaf september 33 tot september tot november, volgens mij was het een maand of twee, is toen de rechtszaak geweest van de brand. En de hoofdverdachte naast Marinus van Lubbe was een man die heette Georgi Dimitrov. Georgi Dimitrov was de hoofd van de internationale, dus van de communistische beweging, werd later na de oorlog eerste president van Bulgarije. Er was een Duitse communist die gearresteerd is op de avond van de brand. En dus Dimitrov met zijn assistenten Popov en Tanev. En zij zijn dus weer naar Moskou gegaan en vertrokken. En bij Marinus is eigenlijk 3 dagen ongeveer na de veroordeling kop af. Dat gerechtsgebouw is na, in de Oost-Duitsland na de Tweede Wereldoorlog, is dat het Dimitrov Museum geworden.
Goed zo.
Ter ere van die man.
Ja.
En het plein daarvoor heette ook Dimitrov Plats. In de begin jaren 90 had Leipzig, de burgemeester van Leipzig, een probleem met het museum en het plein. En vroeg toen, wat moeten we hiermee? Waarop ik een mailtje heb gestuurd, een fax heb gestuurd en zei van, dan noemen jullie het toch gewoon het Van de Lubbe pleintje. En daar heeft hij toen hartelijk om gelachen en zei van, ik geloof niet dat dat mogelijk is. Maar, en toen is eigenlijk dat hele proces begonnen waarop hij zei van, ja maar, de boep had ja geen Steiner zijn draad. En toen hebben wij gezegd van, nou dat gaan wij dan even regelen. Ja. En dat is toen die 3 stenen, eentje in Leiden, eentje illegaal in Berlijn, lang verhaal. En deze zijn toen in een periode van 6-7 jaar, zijn die gemaakt met het verzamelen van geld van... Met de hoed. Dus door activiteiten te ontwikkelen, met kunstenaars, etcetera, is toen al dat geld bij elkaar verzameld. En zijn die 3 stenen dus uiteindelijk gemaakt. En daar zijn we dus vandaag nu, Niels en Jos, samen met Iliana. Weet je toch?
Ja.
Met Iliana hebben dat zijn 3 Leipziger, zeg maar even Leipziger kunstenaars, die hebben mij een paar maanden geleden gecontacteerd of gevonden. En die zeiden van, die Marinus die moet aandacht hebben.
Yeah.
Dat verhaal in Leipzig is niet bekend genoeg. Nee, en toen zei ik, daar ben ik blij mee, zei ik, adopteer het maar. En toen ben ik in november, zijn we met z'n 4 hier, toen was het al donker. Maar toen zijn we hier in het donker bij de steen geweest.
Ik kan zijn naam niet meer lezen.
Dat is het probleem.
En dat vind ik dan toch wel een klein beetje zo van...
Ja, dat moet je kunnen lezen. Kijk. Yeah.
Ik zei, als ik de volgende keer in de buurt kom, dan ga ik de steen wel schoonmaken. Yes. Ja, die heb ik gevonden op die straat. Zo. Also, ja, daar weet ik wirklich zo in kunstler. Want dan heb ik hier een rode eimer. Die heb ik metgenomen. Die is
Neu.
Die heb ik metgenomen. En der Thomas had investeerd in soda. Bitte sehr. So. Dat legen wir später wieder zurück. Ja? Diese.
Okay.
würde kann man jetzt schon wieder lesen und das sieht gut. Sieht gut aus. Von der Lübbe kann man auch wieder lesen. Und das ist ja, in 3 Tagen ist sein Geburtstag.
Das ist sein Geburtstag. Das ist noch ein Datum. 1933. Und das war der Tag, der Brand an dem Reichstag. Und dann da unten gibt es noch ein Datum. Und das steht 10. Januar 1934. Hinrichtungstag. Und das kann man dann jetzt auch wieder lesen.
So, für ein Jahr oder so.
Bei Marinus soll es immer noch, also es gibt so viele Geschichten über Marinus von der Lübbe. Hat er es getan oder nicht? War er ein Lustboy von Göring oder nicht? War er aufgehetzt worden durch die Provokativen? War er ein Opfer von dem ein kommunistischer Komplott? Oder hat er es wirklich alleine gemacht? Ich habe eigentlich immer gedacht, so, wenn es nicht wahr ist, habe ich gedacht, lass ihm es alleine gemacht haben. Das ist nicht zum Trinken. Also das sind die Samen für ein blumenreiches Samengrab.
So. Schönheit, was jemals war. Größer, dichten einmal. Ich glaube ein Gedicht. Ich glaube über Schönheit, was jemals war. Und ich denke, dass so etwas sein wird. Arbeit. Eine Einheit, durch dich allein ist alles, was ist. Schönheit, was jemals war. Dann nirgends hin. Bleib davon. Ist alles Kristall und Pracht, auch Leben selber, wo jetzt doch hin. Aber oh, alles ist Arbeit, es darf. Dann nicht mehr hoch, dann nicht mehr niedrig, kein Schlechtes, kein Gutes, kein Übel. Alles ist schön und kämpft dafür, in allem und mit allem.
Das Gedicht ist nicht nur ein Gedicht. Das Gedicht ist gefunden worden Anfang 90er Jahre. War ich in Berlin, Hoppegarten, das ist das Archiv von dem Zweiten Weltkrieg, aber das heißt dann, das war in Ost-Berlin und das hieß in den 90er Jahren, vor den 90er Jahren, das Stasi-Archiv. Das war 6 Kilometer. Mappen und Text. Und jemand, ich weiß gar nicht mehr wen, erzählte mir, und 6 Meter davon geht über den Reichstag.
6 Meter
war wow. Reichstagsbrand. Aber die haben mir einen Teil gebracht, das waren die Fotobücher, die durch die Polizei gemacht sind, direkt nach dem Brand. Nicht nur dem Brand im Reichstaggebäude, sondern auch im Stempellokal Neukölln. Rathaus, Rathaus, Roter Rathaus und Berliner Schloss, was es dann noch gab. Also Marinus von Lübbe hat nicht nur den Reichstag angesteckt, er hat versucht 2 Tage vorher noch einige andere Gebäude anzustecken. Da gab es auch noch einige Briefauswechselungen von Marinus und einige persönliche geschriebene Texte. Und zwischen diesen Texten gab es einen ausgeschriebenen deutsch übersetzter, das Niederländische ist verloren gegangen, ein Gedicht. Es gab da ein Gedicht in 3 Strophen. Und das ist geschrieben worden durch Marinus selber. Und jetzt gibt es, ich und Rainier haben dann das Initiativ genommen, um 3 Steine zu machen, wo die Strophen in 3 Teilen auf dem Stein stehen. Möchte man das Gedicht lesen, weil es ist eigentlich noch nie so groß publiziert worden, Bußmann in Leiden anfangen, dann nach Berlin. In Berlin liegt der Stein vor dem Deutschen Theater. Das ist eine lange Geschichte, aber der liegt noch immer illegal oder unerwünscht, schon mehr als 20 Jahre vor dem Deutschen Theater. In die Niederlande haben wir die erste Strophe wieder in Niederländisch übersetzt. Das ist nicht original, sondern von Niederländisch nach Deutsch, nach Niederländisch, weil der Stein ja in sein in die Straße liegt, wo er geboren ist und gewohnt hat. Da spürt man eigentlich, warum wir hier heute sind. Da hoffe ich jetzt, Nils und Jos, Juliane, dass wir oder jemand so nochmal herkommt.
Zeit zu tun. Kalt ist sein Grab mal aus Sandstein geworden, über dem, vor dem, was mal sein Körper war und was in einer Winternacht verscharrt wurde, als es unter keinen Umständen einen Fingerzeig auf ein Grab geben durfte. Millionen Jahre im Berg und irgendwann hat der Fels einen Sprung getan und einen Block geboren. Hat der Steinmetz einen Brocken bearbeitet, hat ihn behauen, hat ihn geformt, hat ihn mit Inschriften markiert, als den Grabstein für ihn, der nicht hier an dieser Stelle liegt, wo der Gesprungene, der Geborene, der Bearbeitete, der Behauene, der Geformte, der markierte Grabstein steht, der ein Mahnmal ist für einen Kerl, ihn, der wie sein Grabstein, wie sein Mahnmal gesprungen, geboren, bearbeitet, behauen, geformt wurde, um hier in Ruhe und auch nicht, vergessen und auch nicht, zu liegen und auch nicht. Niemand ist vergessen, dem kleine Kieselsteine auf den Grabstein, das Grabmal, das Mahnmal gelegt werden. In alter jüdischer Tradition, so alt wie der Sandstein selbst. Unvergessen und auch nicht, wie die alte jüdische Tradition, die abhanden kam und auch nicht. Der Zeitstrahl für das Vergessen des Kerls, der hier liegt und auch nicht, scheint still und leise oder laut und deutlich neben dem Zeitstrahl des Abhandenkommens oder auch nicht, der alten jüdischen Tradition des Kieselsteinchen auf Grabsteine legens, des Kieselsteinchen auf Grabmäler legens, des Kieselsteinchen auf Mahnmale legens herzulaufen. Auf beiden Zeitstrahlen steht markiert eine 12-jährige Winternacht.
Thank you. comadre Catalina, la pobre que mal vivía, 10 hijos que ya tenía, los dormía en la columbina. Cuando esa cama crujía, se sentaba y con desvelo pegaba el grito hacia el cielo y a los santos le decía: